Well, thank you to Wendy and to Marg. I really have been hugely impressed by all three presentations. Absolutely fascinating just to see how the sort of similar problems tackled in different countries around the world, different perspectives on something we think we kind of got a handle on. And it does sort of spark new ideas. So we've sort of looked at demographics, we've looked at the beginning of life, we've looked at the end of life. I'm going to throw it open to the floor because I know there'll be a lot of quite specific questions in a moment, but before I do that, I did see a couple of hands, that's great. I just wanted to ask each one of our panelists one question, which is, it's a word that popped up in your presentation. You talked about street culture, but I suppose the question for us sitting here in the UK is, to what extent are the experiences in the United States, the experiences that you've seen around the world in looking at children in trauma, or the experiences of what you see in Ottawa, to what extent are they culturally and sort of system-wide specific? To what extent can we borrow those ideas? Can we just sort of transplant them into somewhere else? Just very brief answer from each of you. Dennis, what do you think?
Well, I think that there's two levels to think about that. One is on a practice level, the kinds of things that you do, you know, professionals and semi-professionals engaging with people who experience homelessness. The best practices are best practices and pretty translatable. But the issue is they then get embedded in a policy context. And yeah. I think that's the difficulty in translation is that, you know, different countries pay for things in different ways. Different cultures provide for supports in certain ways than others. So I think that that's where it gets more difficult to challenge and translate things from one to another.
Panos, we saw you in lots of pictures around the world in different settings. Did you feel that you were looking at institutions and structures and organizations that were all dealing with fundamentally the same problem in different ways? Or were the differences actually, you know, perhaps cultural differences that changed the challenge?
Well, I think I'm all for diversity, otherwise it'd be a very boring world that were different. But I think if you go beyond that, I think the mechanism is exactly the same. People are exactly the same. People like you here, if they come, the baseline may be lower in a way they're not used to stimulation. So once you ask them, those 3 days I sit at the orphanage with the carers, and to see them thrive was just wonderful. As I said, you forget what they look like, what they wear, it's irrelevant. But of course, yes, as you said, the systems are different, the solutions will have to be adapted, maybe at another level.
Marg and Wendy, you used this wonderful phrase, respect for street culture. And I suppose the reality is that most people in the UK that I know don't really respect street culture. In fact, they think it's pretty rubbish, and they think they know better. But do you think that street culture is the same in Canada, in America, in Europe? And
I think the process of social exclusion positions people to feel that way about themselves and their society. And I think that those of us who work with people as they transition into housing see that the recovery from homelessness eventually for many people is, you know, eventually they move out of street culture and move more into mainstream culture, which I think all of us would agree as a society is where we want people to go. But unfortunately, you know, we continue to have a group of people who are alienated on the margins. And if we're caring for people there, I think we have to understand and respect the culture. We can't understand what life is like for them. If we can't understand what life is like for them, then we also can't understand how to provide care for them in a way that is acceptable for them.
The cardboard box story will stay with me, I must say. The man who wanted his cardboard box to die on, extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Right, I did see some hands. Let's take a couple of questions. Gentlemen there, and then have a gentleman there, and then we'll come to Nigel in front. There's a gentleman over there first, thank you. If you could just give your name when you get the microphone. Don't forget, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, we've still got Galway, Liverpool and Edinburgh watching on the edge of their seats. Hello to all of them, so do speak up.
I'm John Connolly. I'm lead councillor for the Westminster Homeless Health Counselling Service. And it's a question addressed to all the speakers, in a way. I was very struck by the amount of suffering you all deal with in your work, even though for some there's more or less statistical filtering and distancing and communication. But nevertheless, it struck me that the subjects and the topics are incredibly emotionally difficult. So my question was, how do you cope and how do you protect and inspire yourselves in the face of such suffering?
Okay, good question. We're going to take a few, if you don't mind. So, gentlemen on this table over here, just by the, yeah.
Hi, John O'Neill, a member of the Pathway EBE team. I have a comment and a question, just a comment first to Marg and Wendy. What you do is amazing, and I'm sure Ottawa shines a little brighter with you guys and your organisation. And a question is for Dennis. You mentioned a cohort who, in their 20s, you say, started using drugs and committing crime. My question is there any statistical info into what their teenage years were like, what they were doing in their teenage years?
Okay, and then we've got a question from Nigel at the front.
Hi, Nigel Hewitt from Pathway. Again, thank you very much to all of the speakers. That was absolutely fascinating. I was particularly struck by Dennis's presentation. I'm a late baby boomer, and my homeless patients I've watched grow older alongside me. We were hearing yesterday from Al Story, TB Find and Treat, that the average age of homeless people on the streets of London is now going down. So I think we're seeing the same phenomenon in London that you're describing in New York, another cohort of late millennials coming into a sort of long-term homeless population. We spend most of our time fighting to provide services now for people in that situation to change the system to make it better. But what should we, the faculty, be doing to try and influence the government and policy so that we don't spend the next 35 years looking after another cohort of homeless people? You know, do we start building the hospices now for them, you know, for the expansion in 35 years' time? Or is there something more radically different that we could be doing to prevent this slow car crash we're watching?
Okay, three excellent questions. Thank you very much. We'll hopefully have some time for a few more. Marg and Wendy, perhaps pick up on the how you cope question. I mean, you really are at the sharp end watching homeless people dying and holding their hands. How do you, as professionals, ensure that, you know, you don't get pulled down?
Well, I think that in the hospice itself, we have an amazing staff, and we're always there for each other. We help each other through the difficult times, and as I said, for the most part, the hospice is quite an active, happy place where people are living their lives. We understand that when people come to us in the hospice that they've come there to die, and that it's a process that is sometimes 2 weeks and sometimes 18 months. So we get to know people very well. But I think through it all, it's a matter of the staff being there with each other and looking after each other and just being able to talk about it with each other. And once or twice a year, we meet off-site somewhere and we have a ceremony just privately among the staff for each of the people who have died in the last 6 months. And we tell stories about them and remember them and celebrate their lives in a way that we knew them. We don't worry about where they came from, what their past was, but we celebrate their lives in the 6 or 8 or 9 months that they were with us and how we knew them. And that's really what gets us through.
It's one of the things I tell all of our staff, that you have to figure it out. You're going to lose a lot of people along the way and you have to figure out how to deal with it. I think people are really sensitive to, like, all of us have our favorites, and one of the rules in Inner City Health is that everybody has to be somebody's favorite, and you have more than one favorite, obviously, but everybody has to be somebody's favorite, and everybody is very sensitive to when somebody who you really loved a lot dies, and there's a lot of kind of nurturing and caring that goes on because you've lost somebody that's important to you. And I think that for the most part, people get through fairly well. What happens every once in a while is that somebody dies, and it's not usually somebody that you expect, and it knocks you down. Like, you're flat out. You can't deal with anything. You can't go to anybody's funeral. You can't, like, you just are done. And I think that everybody knows that happens once in a while. And when that happens, your team pulls around you, lifts you up, carries you, and eventually you can walk again. Eventually you'll make it through and get to that other part. But I think if you get to the point where it's not painful, where it's not sad, we lost somebody who was a very long-time client who died just the day before we left. And Marg and I have been talking about, and he was like the worst behaved, meanest old man ever in the
world.
My
favorite.
Her favorite.
My favorite.
Yeah, mine too. Like so obnoxious, you cannot even believe. But yeah, like the worst, anyway, the worst, the worst borderline personality disorder, like if you wanted to define all the bad things about it, this would be this guy. But we loved him anyways, and he loved us back. And so we've talked about him all through the trip, and you know, he'll be with us, and we'll always tell, there's a million good stories about him, we'll always tell stories like how he set things on fire, and you know, all that, and we'll laugh merrily, and you know, so, and I think that if you get to the point where those things don't hurt, then you can't do the work anymore. You have to allow yourself to feel, and you have to allow yourself to trust the team around you to be able to help you when you can't do it for yourself.
Pat Panelson, in delivering care for children in trauma, again, you've got to have a professional system, but people are human, they're going to be affected, and they're seeing a lot of distress, a lot of suffering, a lot of screwed up young people. You know, from your own experience of what you've seen in Britain and around the world, What are the sort of systems for ensuring that staff can deal with that?
Well, I mean, before I sort of answer the obvious sort of about supervision, how important it is in the key systems or support for staff, whatever the level, but I think the answer is the personal answer is the same, that when you stop being upset, and I think I'm probably upset more than I used to be, because at the beginning, you want to, I don't know, to put two things by the book, you know, make the right diagnosis, put things in an order. When you do that quickly, then you start asking yourself, well, why did that happen? How can they do that? But it takes its toll as well. And I think working in any field like this, there is a, you know, fear and a reality of burnout. And that applies to all of us.
For those of us who do less sort of, you know, obviously virtuous things, it must be, you know, I'm imagining there must be sort of a sense of satisfaction and fulfillment that you're doing something really worthwhile.
Well, it can be, but I mean, journalists and, I don't know, police people see all sorts of horrible things and have to cope with sort of similar situations. So I think there are similarities. But practically, I think there need to be systems in place and that acknowledgement for volunteers, for caregivers, for all systems of supervision, of some kind of support. Because of exactly what you've said, without becoming emotive, without losing the human touch. But the reality is different things can, you know, people press your buttons for things you don't know. I mean, I remember, for example, I find you feel very difficult, and it took me about 20 years, and I worked with a colleague in Loros, in Leicester, in the hospice. So I went there for a research project, and I felt very uncomfortable. I thought, what is that for? And I realized I had gone through medicine for 20 years, and I have avoided anything to do with oncology, because my dad died when I was very young from cancer. And it struck me how long I managed to avoid it, and avoid it, and avoid it. So we all have our buttons.
Yeah, extraordinary. Dennis, a couple of questions sort of aimed at you, I suppose. One from John here, who was talking about that 20s to 30s cohort and the relationship with drugs and alcohol. Perhaps some thoughts on that. But two, also the sort of planning ahead point that Nigel makes.
So I guess in terms of the substance use, I thought the question also had something to do with teenagers. Did he mention about the teenage years? Was that what it was about?
Sorry, John. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the whole thing.
It was that you'd mentioned that they started using drugs and committing crime in their 20s. I was just wondering, is there any statistics to tell us what they were doing in their teenage years, or in fact what was happening to them in their teenage years?
My suspicion is that people who have serious substance use issues in their 20s are, you know, the what made it serious is they started earlier in their teens. So I think that it clearly predates that, because these are people who are already having severe consequences of their drug use in their early 20s. So that would be my suspicion. But more research, I don't want to go beyond what the data say, but certainly more research is needed about what are these adolescent precursors that are showing up in people who are
homeless in their 20s. Because we are seeing in the United States, but in Europe and most of the Western world, a fall in crime and a fall in drug misuse among young people. So it's quite interesting that we're seeing this slight spike.
Yeah, I think that it may be true that the proportion of the population that is having those issues is declining, but if the population is growing, you still may be seeing a larger number of people affected,
right,
which is what I think is occurring.
Now, should we plan ahead? Nigel's point. I mean, the obvious answer is yes, but to what extent, you know, do we really believe this is a cohort issue and therefore we should be putting money in now?
The number one thing we need to do is avert chronic homelessness for the young people who are experiencing homelessness now. Yeah. And so making sure that we don't, you know, we take it quite seriously that if someone is experiencing homelessness as a young adult, that we don't let it get into a downward spiral and somehow just be accommodating to that. I think what we learned, you know, in the 2000s decade in the US anyway, there was a whole transformation in how we addressed homelessness. We went from a system that was mainly built around servicing and managing the population, making sure they had health care, mental health services, transportation, food, but no one was actually solving their homelessness problem. Okay, lots of people were employed taking care of people as homeless, but no one was solving their problem. That was what shifted in the 2000 period. We suddenly got focused and said, you know, the number one most important service we can do for people who are homeless is to solve their homelessness. Get them into housing, whether it's back with family, in some kind of accommodation, or permanent supported housing. That was the most important service. And of course, in tandem with that, provide the other supports people need. But for years, we were spending all of our time ignoring the most important thing. And I think that for people in their 20s, we have to make sure we're focused on helping get them out. Because when you're on the street, your exposure to violence, victimization, drugs, incarceration, all those things, suicide, everything goes up because you're disconnected. So getting people back into community, connecting them with family, doing family mediation, because the core for many of us, of course, in life, at any age, is to have a strong family connection, connection to community. And clearly for a lot of these people, getting some kind of work skills, vocational connection to the labor market, even if it should be subsidized, it would be far cheaper for us to help pay for people and pay employers to create room for folks in the economy than it is to have them, you know, getting in trouble and developing disabilities and behavioral problems because they're just sitting around all day. So I think that we have to, you know, really be proactive. We cannot just run these emergency systems and think that we're actually adequately addressing the problem.
And as we've been discussing, the situation is getting worse in this country. We've got one of the highest homeless figures we've seen in decades. So it's a pretty urgent situation. Let's hope we can come up with some solutions. I'm sorry, we've run out of time for questions, but it's been another absolutely fascinating session. It's time now for a break and indeed some biscuits before your parallel sessions. Don't forget, if you've got an idea for a think pod, put it on the list. At lunchtime, you can actually go and see the full list and decide what you want to think about in your pod. I'll see you later for the final plenary with a stellar lineup, ladies and gentlemen, at 3:30. See you then. Thank you very much.